If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The New York hush money trial of Donald Trump finishes its first week by seating 12 jurors and 6 alternates as Trump chafes against the judge's gag order. Plus, the Senate votes to summarily dismiss impeachment articles against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We are joined today by my colleagues, editorial board member Manet Ukwe-Barua and columnist Bill McGurn. Judge Juan Merchan intends to start hearing evidence on Monday in the first criminal trial of Donald Trump after spending much of this week on the task of picking a jury. And it must have been a strange experience for Donald Trump sitting there in the courtroom listening to questions asked of these jurors about him, statements made by the jurors about him. Here's one. This is from the Washington Post live blog of events there in the courtroom. One potential juror saying, "I'm born and raised in Brooklyn and New York, and I've kind of spent my whole life knowing about Donald Trump." Another asked whether he had views of Trump, saying, "Not strong opinions, but as a wannabe hockey player, thank you for fixing that Walman rink that no one in the city would fix." Not everything positive, though. One juror was disqualified, struck for cause by the judge after Trump's lawyers raised questions about social media posts she had made in 2016, saying that we must protect the rights of people at risk from this racist, sexist, narcissist, unquote. And Manet, it must be an odd experience to sit there as a very famous defendant listening to the views of a random selection of New Yorkers have of him. But what do we know now about the 12 jurors who have been selected to pass judgment on the case that is being brought by Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg?
Well, we know that it's a New York jury, and there is no getting around that fact. I think listeners might remember that when the charges were first brought by Alvin Bragg, Trump tried very hard to get a change of venue because he knew that the Manhattan jurisdiction in which he's being charged is going to be a place where it will be very hard to find 12 sympathetic or even truly neutral people. Obviously, New York is known as one of the most progressive cities in the country. And to read the coverage of the identities, just in sketches that of the reporting that's come out from the people who were in the courtroom during selection, they seem mostly to fit the bill. I mean, you can correct me if you think I'm being unfair, Kyle, but the rundown of some of those personalities, you have people describing the places where they get news, and just about everyone cites the New York Times, National Public Radio, some other very well-known left-leaning outlets. Most of them mention that they do have views on Donald Trump. And to read between the lines, you could kind of see that most of them were unfavorable. Not all of them. There was one lady who lived in Harlem who said that she likes that Trump speaks his mind. But for the most part, they were saying that they have disagreed with some of the things that he'd done during his presidency. But the line, the test that was given to them, of course, was not, do you have any opinion about Donald Trump? Because to be fair, it would be impossible to find jurors anywhere in the country who didn't. The test was, can you be impartial despite your views? And you would hope that for some of them, that's true. But if you're Trump, listening to these responses that they're all giving, you're going to find that very hard to believe, and with good reason. And so I think a lot of people are going to be looking at the charges, which, as we have pointed out, seem like a stretch in various regards. The 34 counts of election fraud that Trump is being charged with seem to be very novel legal theory. But it's very possible that because the jurors are coming from a standpoint of being skeptical of Trump and perhaps a little bit willing to lean in the direction of convicting if the evidence ends up being muddled and if the prosecution's able to make a decent case, we might have a foregone conclusion in terms of how this is actually heard. And that's really hard to get around.
It is an anonymous jury. So we have sketches of these 12 people and their media consumption habits and so forth, their professions, where they live, but not much more than that. We don't have names. There was a juror number 2, who was selected earlier this week, and the media had described her as an oncology nurse at Memorial Sloan Kettering, living on the Upper East Side with her fiance, and who likes taking her dog to the park. And the next day, She came in and said that family, friends, colleagues had more or less guessed that it was her, identified her from those details and began pushing things to her phone. And so she was then excused. The judge subsequently asked the reporters in the room to be more circumspect about the way they described jurors, to not give the physical attributes of them, which he said served no purpose at all. And he said that he would strike from the record any specific names of their present or past employers, even though he acknowledged that the lawyers for both sides might need that information to be discussed inside the courtroom as they're making decisions about how to use their strikes of jurors and so forth. But Bill, there's been some discussion of the fact that, as Monet says, this is a New York jury pool. And so in this 12 people, we have two people who are lawyers. One of them is described as a civil litigator. One of them is described as a corporate lawyer. And some speculation about whether that might be favorable to Donald Trump here, because remember, the case that is being prosecuted is this falsification of business records felonies. And in order to prove that, the prosecution has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt not only that Donald Trump falsified these business records, but that he did so with the intent to commit or conceal a second crime, which might be tax fraud or which might be a campaign finance violation. Bill, what do you make of the idea that having two lawyers on this jury might suggest that there are at least two people in that room who are really dialed into this fact that that second crime has to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt?
I don't know that lawyers are any better on these questions than ordinary people. Look, we've discussed before, I think this is a very flimsy case with a lot of dubious legal theories behind it, you know, taking a misdemeanor and strapping it to another crime to get a felony, 34 felonies. So I think there's a lot of openings for appeals later. I don't know how it's going to be settled. I do think Trump's at a disadvantage. A Manhattan jury, you know, most of the people voted against, what was it, 80-something percent for Joe Biden. But he has one advantage in that he really doesn't have to win. He doesn't need a not guilty verdict. He needs just one person not to go along with the guilty verdict. So the prosecution needs a unified jury, and Trump just needs one person to have doubts to have it end. Now, again, they could retry him, but I think that's highly unlikely given these kind of charges. So it may even up a little bit.
Hang tight. We'll be right back in a moment.
If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Welcome back. Another question that has gotten some attention this week is the gag order issued on the defendant Trump by the judge. Let's listen to a clip of Donald Trump outside the courtroom on Friday, making the argument that this gag order should be lifted when the judge has a hearing on it next week.
The gag order has to come off. People are allowed to speak about me, and I have a gag order, just to show you how much more unfair it is. And the conflict has to end with the judge. The judge has a conflict, the worst I've ever seen, and it has to end with the judge. The gag order has to come off. I should be allowed to speak. Every time I come out to speak to you, I want to be open because we did absolutely nothing wrong.
The gag order issued by Judge Mershon, to my eye, is mostly a pretty narrow order. He cited an obligation to prevent outside influences, including extrajudicial speech, from disturbing the integrity of the trial. And so the order says that Trump is not supposed to, while the trial is going on, make statements about probable witnesses in the case, court staff, prosecution staff, as well as their families, and jurors and prospective jurors. And Monet, the argument for this kind of order in a proceeding like this is to prevent statements that might be arguably intimidating to witnesses, jurors, people who are anonymous. In one of the federal cases, for example, one of the witnesses might be a IT staffer at Mar-a-Lago, the club in Florida. And that person is not famous. That person does not have a big microphone or a platform of their own. And the same is true, I think, of these jurors and potential jurors. And as the excusing of juror number two earlier this week shows, asking these people to dive into this case for the good of justice in order to guarantee that every defendant has the right to a trial by jury of their peers, which is guaranteed in the Constitution, that's an easier lift if those people who are anonymous and, again, don't have their own platforms and their own microphones, if those people think they are protected from the Trump tweet or the Trump's Truth Social post, as it may be these days.
Well, right. I think the question of the gag order is a completely fascinating and fraught issue at the heart of this case. On the one hand, gag orders obviously are run-of-the-mill in high-stakes trials to protect witnesses from intimidation. They want to know that they'll be able to appear without being attacked or publicly slandered. And that's even more important in this case because the defendant is someone who has massive national and international reach and incredible loyalty among his followers. And so if Trump were to attack one of the anonymous witnesses, he could really completely change their lives, their reputations, and maybe even bring a threat upon them. And so, as you said, Judge Merchan issued this gag order, which was circumspect in some ways and was meant to protect witnesses from exactly that, the idea that Trump could name them publicly and they would be perhaps intimidated from appearing in the first place, or if they did, would face reputational damage. But if we back up to the very beginning of the trial, as listeners will remember, there is another issue which cuts in the other direction, which is, of course, the fact that Trump is a presidential candidate, as he was alluding to in that clip, and he has to be able to defend himself, not just in the courtroom, but publicly. And if he thinks that there are witnesses who are biased, of course, he's going to want to be able to make that case publicly. And the same goes for Judge Merchan and others. He wants to be able to say, and has a lot of reason to say, that this is a biased proceeding, that these charges should never have been brought, and that's something that American voters need to hear his perspective on to be able to make the choice that they really want to make in November. And so trying to get that balance right is a very difficult one. I think, as you were implying, one of the standards that should be used to differentiate between what Trump is able to say and what he isn't is who the target of his attacks is. Judge Merchan himself, of course, is a public figure. Even if he's not famous, he is clothed in the official power of the government and has willingly stepped into that role as his profession. And so if Trump wants to attack him, he should be able to take that. And I think the same goes for Michael Cohen, of course, who has become a household name over the course of the past several years of being in Trump's orbit, and who has been willing to go on television and attack Trump and call him a liar himself. He's obviously going to be a key witness for Alvin Bragg in the prosecution, and Trump wants to discredit him. And it seems very reasonable to think that Trump should be able to do that. If he's going to be attacked publicly, he should be able to defend himself publicly. But it's very difficult from the perspective of Judge Merchan to create a gag order that is able to narrowly differentiate among these different types of people. I don't know what ability, if any, he has to amend the order he's already given, or if he would be willing to do that. But it does seem as if Trump has the slight edge in this argument, saying that he's being constrained a little bit too tightly as things currently stand.
A couple of good points from Manet there that I would underline. One is that the gag order issued by the judge does not protect the judge himself, and also does not protect the district attorney, Alvin Bragg. And I think I agree appropriately so, because those are two people who have public offices and are presiding over this trial, or in the DA's case, bringing these charges. And nothing in this gag order prevents Donald Trump from going online, going on Truth Social, and lambasting the judge and lambasting the district attorney. On the point about Michael Cohen, I think that's an interesting one, because he is on the potential witness list here and so would be protected from criticism under the terms of the order as I read it right now. But Michael Cohen is a public figure in his own right and has been on something of a media tour lately. Let's listen to him on MSNBC this past weekend.
Every time Donald opens his mouth, you know that something non-truthful is coming out of it. We also know that he's not a good defendant. He's not a good witness. We watched that with the E. Jean Carroll case, when he couldn't even identify E. Jean Carroll, and confused her with Marla Maples. He is not a good witness. He's not going to take the stand. In fact, I hope that I'm wrong, because I think that would be absolutely classic for America to be able to see Donald Trump on the witness stand trying to defend himself in a case that's indefensible.
Bill, one of the things that the prosecution is now citing as it asks for the judge to hold Trump in contempt for violating the gag order are Truth Social posts attacking Michael Cohen. Trump called Michael Cohen a disgraced attorney and a sleazebag. And it seems to me that those are probably in violation of the terms of the gag order. On the other hand, it's an odd sort of asymmetry if the witness can go on national television and call the defendant a liar, and the defendant is not allowed to respond.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you just made Donald Trump's argument. This is a problem with the order. Gag orders are not unusual. Usually they apply to both sides. But as we see with this case, everything is going to be contested and have wrinkles we didn't know about. We have to remember, Donald Trump thinks, rightly, I think, these are charges that never should have been brought. It's an unfair trial. And I think he's trying to make that case to voters because he is running for president. So his primary thing is he's kind of saying, I'm not going to win in the courtroom, so I'm going to make my case outside. And the problem is that's kind of a trap for the judge and the prosecutors, because the more they punish him, the stronger seems his case that he's being punished in a unique way. So I think we're going to see a lot more of this before the trial ends. I think you're right about Michael Cohen, the problem and the distinct double standard that he can talk. He can go on TV, in fact, and Trump can't. Trump's going to exploit all those things, which may not help him in court, may hurt him in court, but it may help him politically.
But that dynamic, that political dynamic, is worth keeping in mind for the judge, potentially, Manet, because Donald Trump may want to be sanctioned here. Politically, there might be nothing better for him than getting some enormous fine for breaking these gag orders or getting sent to jail for some period of hours or a day or two. I think that the judge probably has an instinct to vindicate the authority that he has to maintain decorum over the proceeding that's happening in his courtroom. But there is an element of not giving Donald Trump, in this case, maybe what he actually wants.
Absolutely. I do think that the decision in front of Judge Merchan about how to tailor the gag order has more to do with what's right and what's wrong. He should seek to protect witnesses from unfair attack, and he should seek to make sure that Donald Trump's right to speak freely to his followers is unencumbered and that he can still make his case as a presidential candidate. But frankly, it probably won't be decisive in what Trump chooses to do, in the sense that if he decides that he has more to gain politically by making attacks, he's going to go ahead and do that and probably think that the boost he'll get from the support of his followers is worth whatever penalty he'll have to face, be it a fine or perhaps even the possibility of a jail sentence. But I do think that it's possible that it's already helping him, that he's able to mention the gag order as one more piece of evidence that this case is being brought unfairly to push him to the sidelines politically, that the charges are completely trumped up, that Joe Biden leaned on Alvin Bragg to bring them. And again, there are a lot of people who don't take much convincing to believe that that's the case, given the number of charges that Trump faces, the fact that just about all of them were based, at least in part, on novel legal theories, the fact that this is unprecedented to have a running candidate facing these types of charges in the first place. And so I think that he is going to find a way to turn this to his advantage, especially among his most fervent followers, and he seems to already be doing that.
Hang tight. We'll be right back after one more break.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Let's turn to a piece of news in Congress this week. Earlier this year, the House of Representatives passed two articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. Article 1 for willful and systemic refusal to comply with the law, and Article 2 for breach of public trust. Those articles were then delivered over to the Senate, where impeachment articles are tried. And what the Senate decided to do was to dispose of them summarily. One of the votes was 51-48, with Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski voting present, and the other one was 51-49. The argument from the Democratic leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, was that these articles did not meet the constitutional standard of high crimes and misdemeanors. But let's listen to a piece of the House Speaker, Mike Johnson, and his disappointment at the Senate's move.
There should have been a full trial. The American people should have been able to see the evidence and evaluate for themselves what I think they know already intuitively, and that is that Secretary Mayorkas had a fantastical breach of duty. I mean, he breached his constitutional responsibility. He's openly defied the federal law on immigration and the will of Congress. In my view, he has lied on multiple occasions to Congress under oath, and I think he's done it to me when I used to serve on the House Judiciary Committee. In my view, I believe my evaluation is he's probably the least effective and I think most dangerous in terms of his policy implementations of any cabinet secretary in the history of the United States.
Bill, what do you make of this as a political end to the impeachment push for Secretary Mayorkas?
Well, we knew it was coming, wasn't going to result in a guilty finding. It's lamentable. I actually think you can make a case for impeachment for dereliction of duty. I do think you can make that case. I think that prudence would say it was not wise to bring that in the circumstances, meaning a Democratic Senate that would never convict, and also all the other investigations, the impeachment for the president, all the other things going on. It's just a lot of freight to put on Congress at this time. And I think the Republicans probably would have been better off interviewing him, printing their findings, then leaving it to the people to decide. The Republicans are winning on the immigration issue. I don't know that impeaching Mayorkas, like finding him guilty, would make much difference to that.
To my eye, it looks like another exercise in defining down the constitutional power of impeachment. And part of it is the political case that Bill just made, that if you have divided government and you have a Senate that is no way, no how going to convict Alejandro Mayorkas, then what are you doing sending an article of impeachment over there? The other piece of it from the House's perspective, though, is just that Alejandro Mayorkas, the Secretary of Homeland Security, what he's doing is he's executing the policies of President Biden. And I agree that President Biden's border policies have been ineffectual and have been damaging to the country. But that's on President Biden. That is not on his Homeland Security Secretary. And the Republicans need to make that case in the election that is coming here in a matter of months to replace President Biden. And on the Senate side, Monet, though, it is a fascinating precedent now of taking an impeachment article that has been passed by the House and doing basically nothing with it. And it seems to me that if that's where impeachment is going, then the next time that Democrats move an impeachment article, Republicans, if they control the Senate, are just going to do the same thing.
Right. I think I agree with you on both counts. Yes, the Senate has generally been understood to have the responsibility to take up impeachment charges, but also that it probably was a stretch on the part of the House to impeach Mayorkas on the charges that they brought against him. If you look at Article 1 of the Constitution, it does say that the Senate shall have the sole power to try impeachment. It doesn't say that they must do that, but historically, when presented with charges, they have always taken them up and rendered a verdict, much in the way that a jury considers the charges that come out of a grand jury indictment. They believe that they have a responsibility to sit, and they also have the ability to structure the nature of the trial. And so if they wanted to do it in a shortened or expedited version because they believe that that's all these charges merited, they could have done that. But as you and Bill were saying, they did take a fairly unprecedented step in dismissing them without actually weighing evidence. And that hurts them politically because it suggests that they aren't taking seriously the charges that were made against Mayorkas and the Biden administration's handling of the border. And it also is something that is going to create a foundation for the same thing to happen again, perhaps when more serious charges are brought against a sitting officer of the United States. And so we could be descending into a situation in which houses are very quick to impeach, but when the Senate is controlled by the opposite party, that doesn't actually get taken up and heard, which could be a dangerous situation. The issue will be handled eventually in November. Republicans are going to keep making their case that Biden and Mayorkas mishandled the border and are going to be running on that and making the case before voters, as they ought to. I think that the whole impeachment process was really just a move to aid that. They didn't think it was enough to be repeatedly saying that Biden has led to the biggest influx of illegal immigration in this country's history, but wanted to show that they had taken action. And impeachment is something that they felt that they could reach for in order to get that message across to their supporters. So I think it was a stretch on the part of the House Republicans to bring it. But ultimately, this was all about politics to begin with. And the better move for them is going to be continuing to show the worst examples of what exactly the Biden administration has done and put it before voters so that they can make their choices November and potentially lead to an actual change in policy.
Thank you, Manet and Bill. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button, and we'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.